Okay, so why don't we get going? So of course, any time a graduate student finishes up a program successfully, it's typically a bittersweet kind of experience. Bitter, of course, because someone who's grown to be a valued colleague is sort of leaving the nest, and we don't have their day-to-day company. And sweet, of course, because they've been successful, and so we usually have a blending of those two kinds of emotions. Today we have the exit seminar of Francis Sivakov, and unusually, it's not the typical mix of emotions. Why? Because Francis actually left us about a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, to go to North Carolina where her husband had a postdoc position. So she's been doing all of her analysis and the final stages of her writing there. So we were sort of weaned of Francis about a year ago. We got through all the bitter stuff. And so today we have only the sweetness of that. That's nice. So Francis is going to give her exit seminar in the ecology graduate group. And let's see, so a few other things. Of course, we all know that it's always a happy day then when the program is successfully completed. You know, any PhD thesis is always a challenge. It's always there are always all kinds of difficulties that are encountered. For some people, there's an unusually large number of hurdles, different kinds of hurdles. And you just pray when you start a project that you won't be one of those people. But if you choose to study long-distance dispersal, as Francis did, you can be guaranteed that you indeed will be one of those people. So Francis managed to overcome all of the obstacles. Some of them were really challenging conceptual problems that she encountered. Some of them were just the normal sort of what you can expect if you're studying dispersal, like the really difficult logistical challenges, and managed to overcome all of those. And I'm really proud of what you accomplished and all the things that you learned. So here's her talk. Pest management from a landscape perspective, understanding the factors that influence the distribution of lichen zespers. Take it over.
Maybe should we turn off the lights
yes.
here? Great. Can everybody hear me okay? Thank you all for coming, and I'm really excited to be giving my exit seminar in the entomology seminar. I've always enjoyed coming to these. And so I thought I'd start with the fun stuff, the acknowledgments. I owe a great deal of debt to the people you see around the border here. While a PhD is often you know, you do your research and you grow as a scientist on your own. It's really a community effort. First off, thanks to my lab mates in the Rosenheim Lab. Thanks for being there for practice talks and for tossing ideas around, helping me with field work or letting me bribe you to help me with field work and participating in general silliness. Thanks to all my field assistants. I had about 10 of them over the years. You can see a lot of their efforts along the borders. And thanks to the Hagler Lab, especially Scott Mackley in the corner there. That's where I did all of my analysis of my protein marking samples, and it was a huge effort. Thanks to the Insect Ecology Lab Group. I've always enjoyed our joint lab meetings and getting ideas and feedback. The entomology department and the ecology grad group, especially Sylvia Hillier, Mark Schwartz, and Sharon Lawler. Thanks for making UC Davis such a fun place to be. I feel really lucky to have had such a rich life while in graduate school, and this is due in a large part to those mentioned. And then finally, like Jay mentioned, you might not have seen me a lot over the past year. I came back occasionally, but what I've been doing is being adopted by the HADAD lab at NC State. I think HADAD and his lab have been nice enough to give me space to write and really kind of grow and be a part of their community, so I really appreciate that. And thanks to my funding sources, this has been huge, as most of you know, for getting my research done. And then special thanks to my thesis committee, former member Richard Plant, and then current members Neil Williams and Marcel Holyoke. You guys have always believed in me and kind of had confidence in my skills as a scientist, even when I sometimes didn't. So I really appreciate that. Thank you. Thanks to my collaborators. You'll hear about them a little bit more during the talk, James Hagler and Eve Carrier. Thanks to my friends, both here at UC Davis and back east in Maryland. Thanks for keeping me sane, I guess. And to my family for letting me take this 5-year vacation, as we called it, to California from the East Coast. It wasn't always easy, but it was worth it. And finally, thanks to my husband, David, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. He's teaching probability, but he's really been a big supporter of me for it all along. Thank you. And last but not least, thank you to my advisor, Jay. Jay doesn't have a lot of silly pictures lying around for a good fodder for exit seminars, but I do have him helping out in the field. I was always, one of the comments that Jay made that really stuck with me was that doing my field work was the hardest he's ever worked in the field. And that always was like, wow, I really am crazy for doing this project. But thank you, Jay. And Jay, I will miss your Jay-isms, but I hope that, and I know that they have stuck with me and really taught me a lot. So, and now, on to the meat of the talk. I was interested when coming to grad school to ask biologically basic questions that were interesting to a wide variety of scientists in applied settings. This is something that Jay does really well, so I chose to work in annual cropping systems. Annual cropping systems are ephemeral habitats, and they're ephemeral both spatially and temporally, as opposed to something like a perennial cropping system, which is like an orchard or forest. And it's not easy to be an insect in an annual cropping system. Your habitat can be there one day and not be here there the next day because of harvesting, pesticide applications. The tillage of soil can affect, you know, where you overwinter, irrigation, and also houseplant variety. If you perhaps like a BT modified plant, takes it kind of out of your realm, but. These high risks and uncertainties associated with living in these types of systems can be reduced by certain pest characteristics. Pests can be polyphagous, and what I mean by that is feeding on more than one type of plant or weed in the agroecosystem, and insects can also be mobile. So what polyphagy does then is it allows the insects in the system to feed have a lot more choices of what they're feeding on, especially when sometimes they're not there. And then mobility allows insects to access the landscape on a larger scale. So resources that are distributed amongst the landscape can then be accessible. So I'd like to argue in this talk that to effectively study the distribution and dynamics of insects that are successful in these systems, we have to step away from thinking of agricultural systems like this, kind of on a local field-based level, and instead think about them on a larger scale, something like this. Maybe not quite as large as what you see outside of an airplane window, but this view has always inspired me and kind of maybe makes me why I like to think about agriculture so big. And these ideas aren't new. A lot of the ideas of my research comes from this paper by Kennedy and Storer. And in this paper, they argue that to really understand polyphagous pests in agriculture and understand their distribution and abundance, we need to think about four things. First, characteristics of the subject population, and this includes their dispersal ability. Second, factors associated with the surrounding landscape. Also, harmful agents. I think what they mean here are like predators, but it could also be like pesticides, if you think about it abstractly. And also the abiotic environment. So in this talk, we're going to consider mostly number one and two, but also we're going to talk about predators a little bit as well. The first part of my talk is going to be talking about dispersibility. Dispersibility not only of the pest, but also of its predators. And typically, dispersal ability is studied using mark release or capture experiments. And in these experiments, a focal population is either collected from the field and brought into the lab, or is raised in the lab. And in the lab, they're marked with some kind of marker, and then brought back into the field and released at a focal point. After this release, populations are recaptured at several known distances away, and then you can kind of describe this dispersal ability based on the number recaptured and the distances. But there are a couple difficulties with this method that have ultimately resulted in dispersal being something that's very hard to study and done on a very small scale. First, you're limited by the number of individuals that you can mark. And what this does is it then, in turn, limits the number that you can release and reduces the likelihood of recapturing marked individuals. So as a result, these studies are often only done on a very small scale where you actually have a decent chance of recapturing marked individuals. They can also alter the behavior of the insects by this whole rigmarole of collecting and marking and releasing, so that's challenging as well. And also there's this idea of the area dilution effect, which means that as things spread out from a central point, the likelihood of recapturing them decreases. So all of these things have resulted in dispersal being very difficult to study and not done very often. And as infrequently as dispersal is studied, the relative dispersal ability of predators to their prey is done even less. While it's not really done very much empirically, there are a lot of theories about predator movement relative to prey movement. And one of our untested assumptions is that prey outdisperse their predators. And this is an idea that was presented in Huffaker's original paper, who's incidentally my academic great-grandfather, which is cool. And what the idea is that the predator-prey interaction was able to stabilize because the prey outdispersed the predators. And when the predators caught up, they decimated the populations, but there was always still prey in the system because they were able to outdisperse. And while this has kind of been thought a lot about theoretically and modeled, it hasn't been looked at empirically, which is kind of a shame or surprising because it has been shown both in theoretically and empirically that the early colonization of natural enemies is a key feature in the suppression of pest populations. So this is obviously a big interest and concern to entomologists and biological control specialists. What we do is, in the first part of the talk, what I'll discuss is a large-scale mark capture experiment that we did where we were able to describe both the dispersal of the pest and its predators. And we were able to do this using protein marking. And I'll describe protein marking. And then I'll take a short detour and talk about an improvement to the analysis of protein marking data, which was able to extend its application from small-scale studies to larger-scale studies, and which was essential for analyzing my data. The second part of the talk, we'll talk about the effect of landscape on focal insect or pest populations and dynamics. And traditionally, the relationship between landscape structure and sort of the population dynamics of a focal insect have been studied using correlative methods with focal patch studies. And what that does is relates some feature of the population, like its density, to some description of the landscape. But these are very sort of high, they require a lot of effort to get this kind of data, so there's often a trade-off between size of the data set and the sampling effort needed to answer use these kind of methods and answer this type of question. So as a result, most studies are modest in size. And what this does is, while you can ask more pointed questions, like how does crop type X affect the focal density, it doesn't allow for a real exploration of what's going on in the landscape. And that's because these small data sets impose limits on statistical power. So in the second part of my talk, I'm going to describe our work to correlate densities of a focal of a pest in a focal population with the presence of a wide variety suite of habitat types. And I do that using a pre-existing survey data set. And this allows us, and I'll describe what that is, but it basically allows us to have a lot more statistical power because of the very large size of the data set. And so we ask these questions with the focus of Lycus hesperus, the western tarnished plant bug. And this is a generalist functional herbivore that has over 100 species of plants, feeds on 100 species of plants in 24 families. And when I say functional herbivore, what I mean is, like most true bugs, Lycus is actually an omnivore. But in California, at least, we've really only seen it act like an herbivore, so functionally, or for our purposes, that's what it is. It's had a long and rich history of study in the UC system, including UC Davis, and a lot of its effort has been focused on cotton, and because it's a major pest in cotton. And in terms of its dispersal ability, I was interested in Lycus because it's kind of been studied on a small scale and gotten one answer, that Lycus doesn't move very far. And then on a larger scale in a correlative study, Lycus has been thought to move from up to 1,500 meters away. So the potential to move very far, but actually marker capture-wise, it's only been shown to go very short distances. Lycus is interesting because while it's a major pest in cotton, it displays a preference for other common hosts in the agroecosystem, including alfalfa. And like I said before, it has a long, rich history of study. Here are a couple of the kind of key players in Lycus history. And the history of Lycus research. And what's interesting is cultural controls have been developed because of this strange thing that the vulnerable crop is not the preferred crop. So techniques have been proposed like intercropping, interplanting, where alfalfa, a preferred host, is interplanted with cotton to hope that all of the Lycus will just move into that alfalfa and stay out of the cotton. And the other idea is this thing called strip cutting, where you have an alfalfa field, and the grower harvests only in strips, so that the Lycus that are currently in the alfalfa field will be displaced, but they'll be able to move it right into some more delicious alfalfa. So one other observation that I noted was that to really be successful in this field, you had to have a V in your name. So I decided to do a little modification, and I made Jay a real success. But don't worry, I'm already covered. Nice. And now we're good to go. All right. So, like I said, this is kind of, from our long history of study of Lagos with the yearly kind of colonization cycle, as we know it kind of looks like this, and I decided to depict it in a hokey cartoon. So at the beginning of the growing season and overwintering, Lagos are thought to be in weedy field margins and perhaps in the weeds in the foothills surrounding the San Joaquin Valley. And when those dry down, Lagos are thought to move into early season crops like alfalfa. So like here, the blue is going to represent alfalfa. They're going to be really happy because they've got a really high quality host and build up large populations. But alfalfa is harvested every 30 days or so for hay, hay alfalfa. And this causes the environment to go from perfectly lovely one day to inhospitable and prompts a dispersal event. And the insects can then move into surrounding fields, often which are vulnerable cotton. And it's this movement that we decided to study in our large-scale dispersal system. So some scientists put their merit on how many papers they get or their citations. And at least for this study, I really kind of valued how many large pieces of equipment I could use in this experiment. So this experiment's also known as, you want to put what on my fields? I'll get into that. So, like I mentioned before, we decided to use protein marking as our marker type. And how it works is a protein mark is detected using protein-specific antibodies in an ELISA, an enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. The mark is applied externally as a spray or internally in the insect's diet. It can be used for things like predator gut assays, but it's not what I used it for. And insects pick up the mark by either getting sprayed directly or walking on sprayed plant material. It has several key advantages that kind of overcome the traditional problems with dispersal studies. Specifically, insects can be marked directly in the field. Marks are easily obtained and inexpensive, and the ELISA technique is simple and rapid and cheap. So when things are marked directly in the field, you can mark a huge source population. I did this experiment 3 times, and the sizes of the marked area ranged from 14 acres to 72 acres. So imagine the insect population in that marked area that was sprayed. So there are 3 types of common food protein marks that are currently in use. The first of which is milk, the second of which is eggs, which I also use, and then the third is soy, which I do not use. And when I say cheap and inexpensive, I mean that I can get a whole lot of it very easily. This is Jay staring inquisitively at the pallet of milk that I've had getting loaded into my truck to take down to the field. Also loaded by a giant forklift, which might count as a large piece of equipment, number one, if you're keeping track. Okay, so here's what I did. Once I had my protein loaded, I was ready to go. I loaded it into my truck, thanks to UC Davis here for allowing me to rent the largest truck possible with a normal person license. It even made a beep beep noise when I backed up, and I was petrified, but it was awesome. And then came the best 15 minutes of every field season when the crop duster that I hired sprayed the protein onto the alfalfa field. And fortunately for you, I have video of it. So you're going to see the airplane, hopefully you can see, going over my alfalfa. So that's awesome. And then, just because you haven't had enough. Yes. All right, this actually really gets the importance of spraying accurately, which was important for me because I only wanted my alfalfa field sprayed, and it's important for the crop duster because he doesn't want to spray chemicals if he's spraying chemicals for somebody else on somebody else's field. So that really kind of nicely shows this cutoff and that I was sure that the alfalfa field was actually being sprayed. So because I really like large pieces of field equipment, I did this experiment 3 times, like I said, and the first year that I did it might have had the coolest experimental setup. It was sprayed using a helicopter. And then to load the protein onto the helicopter, you landed on a giant tanker truck. To look. And I kind of want to say thank you, or maybe shake my fist at Jay for not letting me go up in the helicopter with the, I don't think it would have been allowed, but he's like, don't even think about it. So after the field was sprayed, the grower cut it after, and this prompted a dispersal event. And then we sampled insects in surrounding cotton fields. And we did this at known distances. You can see all of the field work that I had, for field workers I had up here. And thank you again. It was a huge, huge effort. It's ridiculously hard. We're basically carrying around 10-pound leaf blowers that were shaking as we were doing it and walking for miles. So it was exciting. And sampling was repeated on multiple time points. So I show one of my field maps down here. And I just show this to say that we did this for 3 years, and the scale of each year was different. So the results aren't directly comparable. That's just for future. And here's a little video of what it looks like us sampling, just because I had it. See, I've got like back protection, ear protection. So samples were sorted, identified, and tested for protein. And some of the insects, here's the insects we collected with what we had were different expectations for dispersal ability. We have lacewings and lady beetles, which aren't really thought to be important predators of lagus, but are known to have very high dispersal ability. And then we've got Geocoris and Navis, which are known to be predators of lagus, but their dispersal ability was unknown. So now we're going to take a short break before getting to the results and say that at this point, I had this data and I couldn't really analyze it until I kind of fixed this issue with the protein marking, the analysis of protein marking data. And so that's why it comes at this point in the talk. And what this did was really extend the application of this technique to larger scale studies. So, and the outcome of an ELISA is an optical density score. And basically it's on a 96 well plate, and the darker the color in each well, the more protein detected. So you'll get insects that have a score like this and a score like this, and you're like, what does this mean? And what you have to do is, because it's a continuous score, you have to set a cutoff or a threshold. And when you do that, if the scores for actually marked individuals and actually unmarked individuals are separate enough, the distribution, then setting a threshold would be easy. And everything that was classified as marked would be correctly classified as marked, and those would be true positives. Opposite of that would be true negatives, unmarked individuals. But what commonly occurs is that these distributions overlap. And this results in classification errors. And how those are classified are actually marked individuals, that are incorrectly classified as unmarked. Those are false negatives. And the opposite, and what I would argue as the more problematic, when unmarked individuals are misclassified as marked, false positives. So where you set a threshold is purely dependent on the experimenter and depends on the amount of error that you can, or the type of error that you can tolerate. So for instance, if you have a medical test and a score of white blood cells that misclassifies that classifies someone as sick or healthy, if you've got if the cost of retesting people or calling them, misdiagnosing them as sick is not very high, but the problem of misidentifying an actually sick person as healthy and, maybe perhaps dire consequences they could die, you always want to be on the safe side and have your false negative rate be lower. alternatively, and what I'd like to argue is that false positives are a big problem when you're trying to study long distance dispersal, and I try and show that here. If your true positive population actually looks something like this, and this would kind of be a nice description of the dispersal, when you add false positives, the shape of the dispersal curve then shifts to something like this. And where the big problem is in the tail of the distribution. And the tail of the distribution is actually what you want to know about when you're studying long distance dispersal, where a fatter tail would indicate that the population was spreading faster. So what we identified in our work was that false positives are actually more common than would be expected. Traditionally, this false positive rate is set by taking the mean of the negative controls or unmarked individuals on a plate and adding 3 times the standard deviation. And what that does is actually generates a false positive rate that's about an order of magnitude higher than would be expected. You'd expect 1 in 1,000 false positives, but what you actually get is 10. Second, this false positive rate is masked. So it's a little complicated, and I'll describe it happily to you afterwards if you'd like to do it, but essentially, you don't actually ever detect false positives amongst your negative controls. So a researcher is misled into thinking that they have no false positives when they could actually have very many. And the third problem is that this false positive rate is exaggerated, and the problem is exaggerated when you have not normal data. So very quickly, what we found was that instead of the expected rate of having 1 in 1,000 false positives, what we were actually finding was 44 in 1,000 false positives. And when you're only collecting, when you're only interested in that, like 1 in 1,000,000 or 1 in a needle in a haystack chance out at long distances, this is actually an unacceptably high rate. So very quickly, what we did was the reason why the false positive rate was so high was a poor estimate of the standard deviation. So we transformed things using a standard normal variate transformation, and I'll be happy to answer questions about that later. Which basically puts things, takes away differences between plates. We used a different sort of way, calculated a threshold based on the other 7 values of the 8 negative controls to unmask any false positives, and we used a threshold that didn't depend on the shape of the distribution. So what resulted was instead of a 44 in 1,000 case, we reduced that to about 2.5 in 1,000 false positives, which is a much more reasonable level. And the number of actually marked individuals that were correctly marked, were correctly identified as marked, did not vary very, very much. So I just kind of show that here. And what's exciting, I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit, but what's exciting is that these methods that I kind of just described are already in use. Some of you might remember Dominic Reisig, he just graduated. He's studying the movement of stink bugs, and he's using ELISA to protein marking to identify that movement. And he said that my methods have kind of improved his confidence in this. So I think that's really cool. So, diversion over, and we're going to move back to the results of the long distance dispersal study. Just to remind you, relative dispersal of predators and pests. And so now with actually a high degree of confidence that the marked individuals that I collected were actually marked, we were able to ask, are there differing dispersal abilities between species? So you're gonna see a couple of graphs that look like this. We're gonna have the distance traveled on the y-axis and then the individual species on the left. And it's a box plot, so the average uncorrected mean distance flown is marked by this little x. And what we found when we use a randomization test was that Liges dispersal appears to fall in between that of its predators. We found that lady beetles tend to not move as far as Liges, while Lace Wings and Navis tend to go further than Lycus. So this is very different from the untested assumption that prey outdisperse their predators. So what I kind of want to just show here very quickly is that we then corrected the estimate for mean distance flown based on the area of the annulus of the ring that we sampled and the number of samples that we took. And you don't remember the, no need to remember the distances on the previous graph, but essentially the rank order is still the same, but the mean distance flown estimate is higher once we correct, because we put more weight on marked individuals that are captured farther away. We did this also, like I mentioned, in the two previous years, but as one might expect when studying a particular insect, you go out trying to find like one thing, like Lycus, and then you don't find it. But we do have for the other 2 years information about some of the predators. In the 2006 data, the scale is much smaller, only 1,200 meters or so, but we did find that Geocorus and Hippodamia moved about the same. And then in 2007, we went out very, very far, and not surprisingly, found that Geocorus went further. So that explains why we can't really compare between years. And that Navis also tends to not go too far, but then we had one outlier that went very, very far. So overall, we couldn't find a difference between the species. So summarizing this first part, a harvest-triggered long-distance dispersal event does not appear to result in Lycus populations that out-disperse its complex of predators. And so the idea that Lycus is under good biological control because its predators can't keep up with it is something that's just not the case here. So it kind of leads us to ask what would be an effective predator for Lycus? So I'd like to argue that it's not just a predator's dispersal ability, but also its trophic strategy. And what I mean, I kind of try to show here. If you've got a specialist predator, an effective predator would be one that goes about as far as it could. Because if the prey outdisperse the predator, then they're going to escape control and populations are going to explode. But if the opposite happens, the predator is going to starve because it doesn't have any food. So things might be better. A better type of predator in this case might be a generalist predator. Even if it outdisperses its prey items, it can feed on alternate prey, waiting for the target prey to catch up. And even better still might be an omnivore, where a newly colonized patch that might not have any insects in it yet, a predator, like an omnivore, can feed on plant material. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to discuss a landscape study where we looked at the effect of particular crop types on Lycus density and focal confidence. So recall that Lycus use a variety of habitat types over the course of the year, and they show preferences amongst those habitat types. And what I like to show in this schematic here is that habitat can have a variety of effects on insect population dynamics and distribution. So we've got the vulnerable crop here in yellow. It might be cotton, could be whatever. And then this is the effect of crop X. If crop X is a high quality host, it could be a source of individuals. The population in that habitat could have a higher birth rate than death rate, and could export individuals if that field is harvested. Alternatively, it could attract individuals, kind of be like a trap crop of sorts, taking individuals away from the vulnerable crop. If it's a low quality host, this is the idea, almost like a sink, where the population dynamics of death rate is higher than birth rate. Or the crop X could have no obvious effect on population growth rate, but it instead could reduce apparency of the vulnerable crop. The insects maybe wouldn't find the vulnerable crop as well, or it could be a conduit of dispersal. And what I tried to show here is like maybe bugs in the landscape move normally through that, but crop X is such that it really kind of filters individuals towards the vulnerable crop. We have certain assumptions based on the past history of Lygus research. We know that safflower is a very desirable, high-quality host for Lygus. So we expect that as the area of safflower increases in the landscape, that the density of Lygus in focal cotton fields will also increase. And similarly for weeds, this is something I mentioned that Lygus prefer weeds and often are present on weeds early in the season and then move off into vulnerable cotton later. So that's the idea that more weeds in the landscape, more Lygus in focal cotton. Alfalfa is one where we saw from my large-scale dispersal study that a harvest event can really trigger movement into surrounding cotton, so perhaps that relationship is positive. But there's also evidence in the literature that more alfalfa in the landscape kind of could attract Lygus away from cotton and perhaps reduce their density in focal cotton fields. So we also have evidence from an earlier study, Carrier, who's my collaborator, that presence of cotton in the landscape could reduce Lygus densities in other focal cotton fields. So what we did was we were interested in a suite of 16 habitat types, which are listed here. That's really the only important information on this slide. And we're able to evaluate their relationships to Lygus density in focal cotton fields, primarily because of our large pre-existing survey data set. It had a lot of power because it was very, very large. And what we did was we used insect scouting data generated by private pest management consultants. And they took sweep samples of focal cotton fields to kind of get an idea of what the density of Lygus was to give recommendations to their growers about spraying. But what does this data do? It like sits in files unused until we come and kind of take it and put it in this very large data set. We estimate Lygus density based on these sweep counts. And we did this for the early part of the cotton growing season. We were interested in sort of colonization cotton, so early cotton, and we didn't want confounding effects based on pesticide, which are usually start spraying sometime in July. So we also had landscape scale data for Kern County in the southern San Joaquin Valley. What we did was we were able to identify our ranches and our focal cotton sites that we also have the Lygus density information for, and then put kind of like 3 kilometer buffers around each of these focal fields. So very quickly, what we did was we had a focal cotton field that we had the density information for, and we put concentric rings up to 3 kilometers away surrounding each field. We then identified the 16 crop types. I've only got 3 highlighted here. We've got green and cotton, blue alfalfa, yellow uncultivated ag, so the weedy stuff. And then we measured the amount of area in each of those rings. And essentially what we had then is we were interested in the correlation where our dependent variable was the Lygus density, and our independent variable was the amount of a particular crop type in a ring. And while you see 12 rings here, we actually only did it on a 3-ring scale. The analysis just worked out much simpler. So it was 1,000 meters, 2,000 meters, and 3,000 meters was the furthest away. So that's what I was trying to say with the area. This is just a little bit of minutia. I'm kind of just going to skip it, but we got correlations for each of the 6 years of data that we had, and then we performed a meta-analysis to get the overall effect of a particular crop type on Lygus density. What we found was that 5 of the crops had a overall positive effect on ligase density. So their presence in the landscape generally meant that ligase densities were higher in focal cotton fields. We also identified five crops that were generally negatively associated with ligase densities. And then we found six crops that were kind of neutral to ligase density. Here's what it looked like overall. And so we had a couple of not surprising results. I think I mentioned them earlier. We've got found that safflower was positively correlated. Uncultivated ag, the weedy kind of fallow fields, those were also positively. Onion is a known host of ligase, so that was not surprising. And then negatively correlated was alfalfa, which I showed previously could have been positive or negative. We actually found a strong negative of correlation. And then cotton, which is something we had expected. And surprising results, which is really interesting because this is something that people who think about ligase every day as for a living don't really consider these crops when they try and think about their management. Grapes came out as positive. And this is likely because of weedy field margins, or I can think of that it's weedy field margins or in between rows. It might be the host, actual host for ligase. And then oats, which haven't been identified as a host for ligase, but the wild type has been, the sister species has been identified for ligase. And it's one of these hosts that dries down, kind of like safflower does, early in the growing season when ligase is just starting to be vulnerable. So this movement out of oats, as the host suitability declines, might be the reason why it is positively correlated with ligase densities. Similarly, we found that almond and pistachio were negatively correlated. Neither almond nor pistachio were thought to be hosts of ligase, so it's likely that this might be a parency effect. Maybe they just can't get through those fields. That's kind of unclear. And then potato is negatively correlated. And this might be a result of grower practices of spraying potato before harvesting. So pesticides might be an interfering factor here. So lastly, we used this information to give a couple of suggestions for the design of agricultural landscapes. First, we suggest avoid planting vulnerable crops near habitats that are positively correlated with pest density. So in our case, that would be like avoiding planting safflower next to cotton fields. Second, we suggest planting vulnerable crops near habitats that are negatively correlated with pest density. So maybe using them as traps. So perhaps planting cotton next to properly managed alfalfa might be a good suggestion. And finally, if vulnerable crops are themselves negatively correlated with pest density, like cotton is, we suggest that clustering those vulnerable crops might be a technique to protect against ligase damage. So this is a summary that I kind of talked about already, but generally, if we take it back to our bigger question, we say that a lot of the landscape really does matter in terms of understanding ligase population dynamics and density. And we showed in our first part that ligase are highly mobile, can use the landscape effectively. And so in closing, I guess I'd like to encourage really the importance of landscape scale management for ligase. With that, I'm happy to take any questions. I haven't thought about that. I mean, we're interested in using the casein protein in the milk. You know, I've also gotten questions about like whether 2% or 1% or skim milk, and I don't think it makes a difference.
The second question is, how did you determine how long you were going to sample after you sprayed the milk? Is it a producer of a test, or did you guys just set a certain time point?
That's an interesting question. We did not do any kind of tests. We kind of just wanted to keep things standardized. So we wanted to wait until so after the cutting, how soon after we sample, we wanted to let things distribute and settle a little bit, but not to go too long. The protein generally lasts up to about 2 weeks, so we kind of just tried to do a time point that was immediately, kind of like 1 day after cutting, and then we tried to do equally spaced time points afterwards. So we ended up doing, in our most successful year, the 2008 year, we did 1 day after cutting, and then 3 days after cutting, and then 5 days after cutting.
So at 2 weeks, it wouldn't be effective anymore?
Generally, the mark, so my collaborator, James Hagler, has done a lot of checking, essentially, and what he's found is that the detection rate of marked individuals declines over time, but probably is less than 60% or so after about 2 weeks.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So I just love the technology, and I like people who think big, so I think this was great. In terms of agriculture versus invasion biology, people are interested, I think, in different parts of that dispersal distribution. And invasion biologists are interested in the WAIFAR tail.
Right.
And I think the WAIFAR tail is important if you're worried about the ligase initiating new populations, but it might be that something like the mode, you know, how far do most of them go, is going to be more important for agriculture if you're worried about these sudden inundations. So have you played around with that a bit?
I've definitely thought about that. It's interesting because cotton is one of these crops that just a little, a low number of individuals detected can be really devastating. So it is more of a kind of a low number issue with that crop. Also, it's interesting because if you get a great influx or like the mode, people just spray, like no problem. And I'm kind of more curious on that gray zone. What happens, like when things are a little bit rare?
So when you were looking through the last little part that you talked about, you were talking about pest densities over that large data set.
Mm-hmm.
Were they different over the course of those 2 or 3 years that you looked at? And was that correlated at all with the amount of alfalfa growing in that particular year, or some of those other crops that you looked at?
That's an interesting question. So, okay, what that would be, is actually it's 6 years of data, and you would expect that if the correlations would be a little bit different if across the years. And we did see differences, and so that's why we're interested in looking at the overall effect of a particular crop. Sometimes those correlations could be strong, sometimes they could be weaker. Sometimes they could appear significant, sometimes not. And so what we were interested is in general. So yeah, there's a lot of variability between
them. I guess I'm just sort of wondering, like, I think this would be hard to implement at a landscape scale, but if you could encourage farm manager practices at a landscape scale, I could see, you know, using the ideas from this study that recommend planting all the negatively associated mm-hmm. crops one year and then,
on a year-to-year basis.
So not just clumping solution, but also clumping
time. That is a very good idea. I had not really thought about that, but I know you think about that.
So I think we have another class coming in at 1, so I think we unfortunately need to skedaddle, but let's